From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. It's Friday, September 14th, 2007. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. We have another action-packed hour ahead.
We are going to talk about Isaiah Thomas, general manager of the New York Knicks. He's being sued for sexual harassment, and the testimony of one of his star players is not helping.
Not a bit. Not what involves an intern and a limousine.
And a strip club.
That's all we're saying. Big week with doings in Iraq. We're going to have some insight on the death of a Sunni leader and a very important leader from someone who actually interviewed him recently, our own Bryant Park Project newscaster, Rachel Martin.
Yeah, right when this event crossed the wires yesterday morning, Rachel walked over and said, this is going to be a big story. Cover the New York Times today, prove that to be right. Also, we're going to check out some of the most popular news stories of the day that are being emailed around and viewed on our patented segment called The Most, including a prank so heinous we have to wonder if it's even real.
Yeah, we're wondering if this is shady. There's also some fragile bones on display. Should one of the oldest human ancestors be taking a road trip? We'll get to today's big stories from our newscaster, Rachel Martin, in just a moment. But first, here's the Bryant Park Project's top story.
General Petraeus believes we have now reached the point where we can maintain our security gains with fewer American forces.
President Bush addressed the nation last night and announced, as we all expected, that he is accepting the recommendations of General Petraeus, meaning troop levels in Iraq could be drawn down to pre-surge levels by next July.
So the president delivered a more upbeat assessment of Iraq and a tentative plan for troop reductions based on the criteria he calls return on success. It might be strangely worded, but I guess you get the idea. Democrats were quick to attack the speech. They said it failed to provide a concrete plan. It offered no new direction. Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed provided the Democratic response.
Iraq's fundamental problems are not military. They are political. The only way to create a lasting peace in Iraq is for Iraqi leaders to negotiate a settlement of their long-standing differences.
As long as we're talking about negotiating political differences, there was one part of the president's speech that was a bit surprising. It was this comment on oil revenues.
Iraq's national leaders are getting some things done. For example, they have passed a budget. They're sharing oil revenues with the provinces.
That statement kind of got our attention that, you know, everything is hunky-dory with the oil revenues. Because just yesterday, like 5.5 hours before the president made that speech, the AP ran a big story that said officials say Iraqi oil talks are deadlocked.
Here's what happened. This meeting between Shiite and Sunni Arab representatives and Kurdish negotiators that was supposed to move everybody closer to a deal, well, it failed on Wednesday, the day before President Bush's speech. So now everyone's debating how much power to give the Sunni area of the country where there isn't much oil and how oil fields should actually be managed. So at least according to the Associated Press, the sharing that Mr. Bush referred to last night is not yet in place. And that is today's BPP Big Story.
As we said, coming up, we're going to talk about Isaiah Thomas. Also, we're going to check back in with our friend who's counting to a million in Alabama. Here's some more of the scintillating sounds of him counting. First, though, let's get the rest of the news from the BPP newscaster, Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. Here's what's going on in your world. The White House has told Congress today that Iraqi leaders are making little progress toward meeting key military and political goals. The report comes just one day after President Bush said progress in Iraq justifies a large continued U.S. military presence there. The administration's first required report on benchmarks last July showed the Iraqi government was making okay progress toward meeting 8 of 18 goals. The follow-up report to Congress today concluded that Iraqis have made progress on only one benchmark, allowing former members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party to hold government positions. And the trial of polygamist Warren Jeffs continues today in St. George, Utah. 51-year-old Jeffs is the leader of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's been charged with 2 counts of rape as an accomplice for using his church authority to coerce a marriage between a 14-year-old girl and her 19-year-old first cousin. The girl, now 21, was the first witness in the trial yesterday and is expected to return to the stand today. Yesterday, she testified that Jeffs, who held the church title of prophet, has long been an authority figure in her life. She said the prophet was as God to us and had jurisdiction over us. The defense is arguing that forced sex was not part of church culture. Here's defense attorney Tara Isaacson during yesterday's proceedings.
Warren Jeffs said, "A man should only have those marital relations with a wife if she invites it."
Jeffs was a fugitive for nearly 2 years and was on the FBI's most wanted list when he was arrested in Las Vegas in 2006. If convicted, he could spend life in prison. Jeffs is not charged with polygamy, and the marriage between the girl and her cousin was monogamous. And there's a big auction of wireless waves scheduled for early next year that will determine what kind of data you can put on your cell phone. And yesterday, one of the big players in that auction filed suit to change the rules. In a lawsuit filed yesterday, Verizon Wireless asked a U.S. Court of Appeals to strike down the FCC conditions that would require the winner of the new spectrum to let consumers connect using any device or software. Verizon argued that the open access conditions are unconstitutional and that the FCC overstepped its authority when it approved them in July. The open access rules have been supported by Google, another competitor in the auction, as well as consumer groups, which say the rules are necessary to spur competition in the wireless industry. I'm Rachel Martin. The news is always online at npr.org. Luke and Allison, back to you.
Thank you, Rachel Martin.
Now it's time to catch up on news from Iraq, a Friday segment that we like to call The Week in Iraq. Ambassador Ryan Crocker and General David Petraeus were on the Hill this week making the case for continuing the American presence in Iraq.
The changes to our strategy last January, the surge, have helped change the dynamics in Iraq for the better.
Democrats and some Republicans greeted Crocker and Petraeus' testimony with skepticism. Petraeus said it was possible U.S. forces could be reduced to pre-surge levels by the summer of 2008.
On Tuesday, the Iraqi oil minister Hussein al-Sharistani declared that an agreement signed between an American oil company and the government of Kurdistan in northern Iraq was illegal. Over the weekend, the Kurdish regional government confirmed it had made a petroleum exploration deal with the Hunt Oil Company of Dallas. It's the first major oil contract by an American company in Iraq in decades. The deal is considered a risk for Hunt Oil since it's unclear whether it comports with Iraqi law.
And that brings us to the collapse of the proposed Iraqi oil law. Parliamentary factions were unable this week to agree on a law to share revenue from the sale of Iraq's petroleum reserves. It's one of the 18 benchmarks that's been set for the Iraqi government.
This week, the Pentagon released the names of 27 U.S. troops who have died in Iraq. Among them were Sergeant Omar Mara and Sergeant Yance T. Gray. You might remember on August 19th, the New York Times published an opinion piece written by Moore, Gray, and five other servicemen, which was highly critical of the American strategy in Iraq. Quote, "The most important front in the counterinsurgency," they wrote, "is improving basic social and economic conditions, is the one on which we have failed most miserably."
And finally, yesterday, a key U.S. ally in the province of Anbar, Sheikh Abdul Sadr Abu Risha, was killed in a bomb attack along with two of his bodyguards. And our own Rachel Martin joins us now. Rach, you actually interviewed Sheikh Sadr for NPR last June, we understand?
I did. I was in Iraq. I was in Anbar province for a week reporting on the alliance between U.S. military officials and these Sunni sheikhs who have been so instrumental in garnering support among the Sunnis for U.S. operations.
And this has been a huge deal this week because the president is trying to say things are going sort of better in Iraq, and a big part of that is that these tribal sheikhs, like this fellow, had been sort of cooperating and teaming up against al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. So tell me a little more, who was Sheikh Sadr and kind of what was he like as a guy?
Yes, he's really considered like this big figure in Anbar. He shows up in a room and people stop and give him all the deference of a prince or some kind of shakely guy, which he was. And he totally looked the part. He would wear white robes and gold embroidered headpieces. And he was a notorious chain smoker. He also had a certain kind of charisma, which put him in this position in the first place. He formed the Anbar Salvation Council, as it was called, about a year ago. And the purpose of this group was to convince other Sunni sheikhs that, listen, al-Qaeda is doing you no good. This group, al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, is wreaking a lot of havoc around here, and they're killing our friends and relatives. Abu-Risha himself, Sheikh Sattar, lost 10 family members to al-Qaeda. And so he had a pretty good case to make, and he convinced a lot of very influential, pivotal leaders in Anbar that, sure, you may not trust all the motives of the U.S. military, but right now they're the ones who hold the power, and they can help us for the time being.
I thought it was interesting. I was reading some of the obituaries of him this morning that they said he wasn't maybe the most powerful sheikh, but he was, you know, or didn't have the biggest sort of, you know, militia, but he was a guy who was willing to be seen in public shaking hands with George Bush. I mean, he just did that this week when the president made that surprise visit.
Yeah, he definitely went out on a limb. I mean, it's not necessarily a safe thing to align yourself publicly with the U.S. government and President Bush in particular. But he was an astute student of geopolitics, and he kind of saw the way the wind was blowing. And they didn't get nothing for this. I mean, in exchange for settling up with the Americans, Sheikh Sattar and other sheikhs got some kickbacks. They got infrastructure in their villages. They got electricity generators, water purifying plants, guns for their individual militias, and cash. And so it was a good deal for him.
Do we know anything else about the kind of circumstances under which he died? I mean, it was an explosion, but are there any other specifics?
All we know is that it was a roadside bomb close to his house in Ramadi. He was apparently he was going about his business as he usually does, going to places he usually does, and he hadn't really mixed up his schedule. So his bodyguards admit that there was a little bit of a security breach on their part by taking him to places he usually goes and following routines, which is how you get killed. There's not any confirmation. We don't know yet who's taken responsibility for this. Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, a Sunni Arab group, has not claimed responsibility. And it's important to note there was a lot of infighting within the Anbar Salvation Council. There were some power struggles. So, you know, it's hard to say who was responsible for his death.
I think there's some talk of his brother taking over his old job. And his brother said, well, you killed my brother, but there were a million of him in Anbar. And I thought, that sounds high. I mean, are there enough people, aside from this guy, who really want to make it work, either at the level of being a sheikh or just people that are in the tribes? I mean, was this guy unique, or is there actually generally a move towards this sort of thing?
Well, this is something that still remains to be seen. They are trying to replicate this. They were trying in Diyala province, which has seen a lot of bloodshed and a lot of U.S. military activity over the past few months. But the problem is that in other provinces, they're much more heterogeneous. The reason this worked in Anbar is because this is a Sunni province. And so there's not the infighting. There's not the sectarian violence. Are there a million other Sheikh Sattars running around Anbar? Not so sure. But, you know, for the time being, Sunni sheikhs there have said, this is the basket we're going to put our eggs in, and we're going to hope that it pays off in the long run.
You actually look kind of sad. You seemed really sad yesterday when you found out this guy died.
He's charming. He was a charming guy. He liked the press. He liked the media. The New York Times had done this big profile of him. They had gone out and stayed with him for weeks. And when I interviewed him, he was saying, when are you going to come out and stay with me? When are you going to come interview me? He liked the media's attention. He liked the position clearly that he had been put in as the spokesperson for this alliance. And so he had to have known that there were going to be some serious risks associated with that.
Yeah, he had survived something like five previous bombing attempts, car bombing attempts. I mean, and his brothers, you read the history of his brothers being killed and his father being killed. And it's just like this guy must have known he was a marked man.
Totally. It comes with the territory. I mean, key leaders, anyone who's stood up, spoken out and said, we think the U.S. is a worthy ally right now, they're marked. Just also when I was there in June, there were four Sunni sheikhs also aligned with Sheikh Sattar who were killed in an explosion in a really popular Baghdad hotel. Hard to say if they were the explicit target, but nonetheless, it's a symbol that when you stand up and you partner up with the Americans, there are some definite risks to your health.
Do you get the sense, too, that when Mr. Bush and when General Petraeus and even Ryan Crocker, when they talked about the success of this guy that they – did they leave stuff out? When I talked about the success, not just of him, but in general in this area, you said it's homogeneous, and so maybe it's not Is there anything else about it that, like, what were they not saying when you were watching on Capitol Hill this week that you had experienced yourself when you were in Iraq?
Well, there was a lot of controversy when this movement first started because a lot of these guys used to work for al-Qaeda elements. I mean, these Sunni sheikhs have their individual militias, and a lot of people in those militias were working with al-Qaeda at some point, working against the Americans. So it's highly possible that in luring these sheikhs and their militias over to the American side, they were bringing over some Iraqis who had perhaps waged attacks on Americans. This was really controversial. Now we're arming these guys, and they were opposed to us 1 month, and now we're giving them more guns. So there were a lot of questions about that, and that still remains controversial. How do you ensure the loyalty? If these people are sitting on the fence waiting to see which way the wind blows, how do you know the next time the wind blows a different direction, they're going to turn around and shoot us again? So there's definitely some controversy surrounding this, but the Americans insist that this is the key, that in order for real change to happen, they need this alliance.
Rachel Martin, our own Rachel Martin, thank you so much for talking to us about the death of this guy, Sheikh Abdul Sattar Abu Risha.
You're welcome.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, there is trouble in the court. Knicks president and head coach Isaiah Thomas is fending off a sexual harassment lawsuit.
And forget that tease. Let's just tell you this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart, along with Luke Burbank. Coming up, we're going to learn more about Lucy's bones, that famous archaeological find that at the time were the oldest human bones ever found.
And, you know, they named them after a Beatles song because that's what they were listening to at the time. But, like, they could have been named, she could have been named Mandy.
Oh.
Or,
do you think archaeologists like Barry Manilow?
I don't know. I actually don't even know if Mandy was written 33 years ago. My Manilow. You know, if you forget Manilow history, you're doomed to repeat it. I think a lot of people don't realize that. All right. Let's actually go to a segment we like to call The Most. Do we have music for The Most?
No, we don't. We actually should work on some Most music, I think. It's actually news decided by the masses. We take a scan of the most emailed and most viewed stories on the web, pick out a few gems for you. We like to invite our producers into the studio to help us understand what's going on. MJ Davis and Dan Pashman are here to help. I was supposed to go first, but I'm going to let Dan go first.
All right, Dan.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. Where's your story from?
My story is from Yahoo News, and it's a story about this tower in Dubai called the Burj Dubai, which means Dubai Tower. It's going to be the biggest building in the world when it's finished, but it has already surpassed the CN Tower in Toronto as the world's largest freestanding structure. It just surpassed it. That's the news that's come about here. I'm just a big fan of engineering feats. It's pretty amazing. The thing's not going to be done for like a year and a half, and it's going to end up being, they say, about 26,000 feet tall. That's about a half mile.
Wow.
And I did calculate, Allison, that's 8.5 football fields.
Thank you. I needed reference points.
And by comparison, the Sears Tower, which is already pretty huge, is 5.75 football fields. So
wow.
That's we're going from 5.75 of the Sears Tower to 8.5 with this thing, and it's already.
Isn't Canada bummed about this?
They are bummed. Some of them are. And I actually got this funny piece of sound from CBC television. They did a story on the CN Tower. We have a clip of that if we can hear that.
The distinction of being the world's tallest is now over. The CN Tower has been officially relegated to second place. On the streets of Toronto, they are mourning the end of an era. On other Canadian streets, though, it's hard to contain the glee.
Heartbroken? On the contrary, who cares?
I guess they better get the big box of Kleenex and get used to it.
Oh, you Canadians.
Oh.
They better get the box of Kleenex.
Cynical Canadians, eh?
When I do a Canadian, it sounds like Ringo Starr. They should get a box of Kleenex.
A little more Liverpudlian.
Apparently. All right, Dan. Next up. Is it okay, Allison, if we go to MJ next? Or
absolutely,
would you dine to do yours? Okay. MJ Davis.
Yes.
You've got something from collegehumor.com.
Collegehumor.com, yes. And Luke, you've seen this video, so chime in. There are these two college kids who are pulling the most ridiculous pranks ever, and they're called pranks 1 through 6. Prank 6 is this nasty plot where this guy fakes out his roommate by buying him and his girlfriend tickets to a Yankees game, and then fake has a proposal up on the jumbo screen. And we have a tape of this video.
So the friend is sitting there next to the girlfriend. The girlfriend looks up on the screen and says, "Oh my God, you just asked me to marry you." But
yeah,
the friend doesn't know.
Yeah, right, and it's a video. It's a video, and it is horrible. Let's listen to a clip of the diabolical scheme.
In the middle of the fifth inning, that jumbotron right over my shoulder is going to display a marriage proposal statement from Streeter to his girlfriend. They have no idea it's coming. I bought two tickets for my friends to sit in tier box 640 row F, one row behind Streeter in a chair. They're going to tape the entire thing as it unfolds. It's going to be pretty amazing. And I also brought binoculars, so maybe I can see it myself.
The thing, though, about the video is that, okay, not to spoil it, but the girlfriend seems very upset, and then she slaps this guy who, you know, is getting pranked, because he says, I'm not trying to propose to you. And the slap is so theatrical that it makes you wonder if this was all a setup.
I kind of think it's a fake. The video is a little too good. They have too many angles to cut to.
Yeah, it's a little – and again, who – like, seriously, is this like a, you know, a duel in the South in the 1800s? Who slaps anyone anymore? So we're going to put that up on our blog, by the way, this video, and people can watch it and decide if they think that this is a really a thing or if this is all put on.
I think it was real. I'm going to go ahead and say it.
Based we got on one what? Vote for real.
She slapped him hard. I mean, she sold it. If that was a fake, she sold it. I think it was
How many
real.
Times have you been slapped that theatrically in your life, Dan?
I have never been slapped theatrically.
Right. Okay. Well, let's, you know, go to the blog and watch the video. We'll link to it, and then, you know, we'll let the people decide.
All right.
What do you say, Ali? Should we try to sneak in your most, or should we just keep it rolling?
You know what? We'll just keep it rolling.
All right.
I think so. You know.
Thanks, you guys, MJ.
Thank
and
you.
Dan
yeah.
Later. Appreciate it.
Actually, we could do a little obnoxious segue. I think this actually could be the most emailed story, the most talked about story in New York City right now. All is not rosy at Madison Square Garden. The president of basketball operations and the coach of the New York Knicks, former basketball star Isaiah Thomas, is spending a lot of time in civil court facing charges of sexual harassment in a $10.6 million lawsuit filed by a former Garden executive, 44-year-old Anushka Brown Sanders. She is also suing for unlawful termination, also naming Madison Square Garden the enterprise and its chairman, too. Isaiah Thomas and MSG have denied all charges. The testimony on the stand's been a little bit raw. At least one witness, a little bit raunchy, including Knicks star Stephon Marbury, who during testimony admitted to having sexual relations with an intern.
Yeah, and I think she was on the cover of the Post today. Yesterday she was blurred out, and now her face is on the paper.
Well, we've got Henry Abbott on the phone. I know you really enjoy reading his blog at Sports Illustrated, right?
True Hoop, which is that run by Sports Illustrated now, Henry?
It's part of ESPN.com.
Oh, ESPN.com. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh. I didn't mean to get to the competition. All right, Henry. So why did this woman bring the lawsuit? What kind of sexual harassment does Ms. Brown say she endured?
It's the most bizarre and troubling story I've read in basketball, probably. But, you know, we only know her testimony at this point in more or less about what happened, and she basically says that she was abused as an employee. You know, people calling her, you know, Isaiah Thomas was just an incredibly abusive coworker for the entire time she worked there. And after, you know, really degrading her and calling her, you know, nasty words that start with H and B, he then started to make some kinds of advances to her, she says, including. I don't know if you saw the movie Love and Basketball, where it's about this couple that are kind of have this on-again, off-again
relationship. I don't know if anybody saw that movie, Henry. Let's just be honest.
I saw it.
Yeah, you. You were the person.
But they quarrel all the time. And they can't decide if they want to be together or apart. And according to her, Isaiah said at one point, oh, we're like the Love and Basketball people. You know, like we hate each other, but we're so similar that we should be together. And at one point, he allegedly said he wanted to be off somewhere alone, off-site with her. And Ms. Brown Sanders took this to her boss repeatedly, Steve Mills, and you know, and he never really seemed to take any action. And you know, he told her she didn't have to go off site, you know, according to her testimony. But
so the lawyers are actually trying to prove that this is systemic within this organization. This idea of looking the other way if there's any kind of harassment in the office, specifically of her.
Right, and you know, I've talked to people who have worked in that organization and were there then, and everybody seems confident in the notion that this was definitely a cantankerous workplace, and they've had a lot of stuff going on. I mean, there, you know, Larry Brown famously came and went in a hail of arguments, and they had to, you know, have it settled in front of the commissioner of the NBA. And there's a kind of a lawsuit brewing involving Rangers, the hockey team that shares the same parent company. The Rangers dancer says that she was sexually harassed, and that's kind of a nasty one too. So there is this little bit of pattern of it being just a bad place to work now. And then there's the reason they brought up Stephon Marbury.
Wait, I want to get to that one more in 1 second. I first want to finish talking about Isaiah Thomas. Is there anything from his past that would suggest that he would behave this way or that he would be a bad leader?
Nothing along the sexual lines that I'm aware of, but the being a cantankerous guy, I mean, everybody in the NBA has heard stories like that. And you know, he famously ran the CBA, the Continental Basketball Association, kind of into the ground and left the owners holding the bag. The other story that interests me is he was a star of the Detroit Pistons and the face of the Detroit Pistons during his playing days. Yet when he was winding up his career, the owner of the Pistons, who presumably knew Isaiah as well as anyone, came to his teammate, Joe Dumars, and said, you know, Joe, we love you. We think you're a special person. We'd like you to take over the team. And people always took that as a sign. It was sort of a rebuke of Isaiah Thomas. Joe Dumars still runs that team. They're, you know, competitors with the Knicks and a much, much better team with a lower payroll. So, you know, there's that kind of indication. And there are other stories about Isaiah just kind of being a vicious competitor.
Is this, Henry, just the kind of final – like straw in the Isaiah. I mean, Isaiah Thomas at one time was one of the most beloved sports athletes because
he—that's the way I remember
such a
him.
Pleasant guy, and he led, you know, Detroit to these championships, and then it turned out maybe he wasn't the greatest manager, or wasn't the greatest general manager, you know, because he was with the Toronto Raptors and he sort of didn't pull together a great team, and then maybe, you know, he's allegedly sexually harassing people. Is Isaiah Thomas just not the guy everyone thought he was, or at least in the public mind?
I mean, I don't know that anybody is. You know, like he was such a smiley cartoon character for a while there. But I have a friend who's a Knicks fan, and he was like, "Look, is there any way Isaiah can win this trial? I mean, think about it. Either he loses and then he's convicted as a bad guy in the court of public opinion, or he wins and then he comes off like the Teflon Don kind of guy where nothing sticks." You know, but we've heard enough now that I think in the public eye, you know, he's not going to look good no matter what happens.
And we should say once again, Thomas and MSG have denied any of these charges. Before I let you go, this part of the story, the Stephon Marbury's part of the story, has kind of hijacked the rest of the story.
Yeah.
Because he was brought on as a witness, and somehow he ended up on the stand and started talking about getting busy with an intern in a limo. How does this even play into this case, this whole part of it?
Her lawyers are trying to establish that there's a pattern of, you know, sexual harassment in the workplace that's not being properly dealt with. And, you know, there was an intern at the place who had a party at a strip club. And I guess there were some people from the Knicks there, including Stephon Marbury's cousin, who was also an intern at one time with the Knicks. And Stephon Marbury's cousin gave her a ride back to the university where she goes to at St. John's. And as she was getting out of the car, Stephon Marbury pulled up in his truck and said, you know, are you getting in the truck? And then she said yes. And, you know, we haven't heard the exact specifics of what happened in the truck, but you can sort of fill in the rest.
No, thanks. I really don't. I don't really want to. Henry Abbott from True Hoops, the blog. Thank you so much for walking us through this story. We'll see what happens. The trial's going to last about 3 weeks, so we will find out very shortly.
Hopefully next time we talk is something a little more positive and uplifting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you can...
Like Greg Oden not playing for the whole
that's
season.
Oh, my team. I don't want to talk about that.
Oh. All right. Henry, nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
This weekend, you can see a gun-toting public radio show host, and I don't mean Robert Siegel in a bad mood.
Hey-o!
The Brave One, starring Jodie Foster as a vigilante radio personality, opens in theaters. It faces competition from a magical musical mystery tour of a film based on Beatles songs and a whodunit starring 3 Oscar winners. What to see? Let's ask Bob Mondello, the film critic for National Public Radio. So, Bob, this Jodie Foster movie, The Brave One, she plays an NPR host who is really, really mad. Why is she so cranked?
Well, actually, I shouldn't be laughing. She is subjected at the beginning of the picture to a really horrific situation. Her fiancé is killed. She is terrified, and she decides to go out and do what all public radio personalities do, which is to buy a gun.
Absolutely.
Now, the problem with the picture, I mean, you know, she's depicted in this way as a legitimate vigilante. I mean, this is a picture that makes the case for, someone who doesn't like guns, who is opposed to all of the kinds of things that are associated with them, picking one up and then going and getting all the bad guys. And it's basically a Charles Bronson picture with Jodie Foster in the lead. The hassle for me, I mean, I went around and sort of jokingly asked people here at NPR if, you know, anybody has a gun. You know, it's one of those things. I mean, there was actually an NPR guy.
Did anyone have a gun?
No, thank heaven. but it is so unlike public radio that I can't. You know how dentists who go and see Marathon Man are probably really upset, right? I mean, because this is not a reasonable portrait of dentists. Well, I sort of felt the same way about this picture.
Look, and we could use a little like toughening up in our image, though.
Oh, well, that's totally true, and she's going to do it for you, because at the end of this picture, you're just sort of cheering her on.
But let's listen to her rage a little bit, so people get a sense of how angry she is.
Cool.
I always believe the fear belonged to other people, weaker people. Never touched me. And then it did. And when it touches you, you know that it's been there all along, waiting beneath the surfaces of everything you loved.
Does the movie hinge on her performance?
Oh, yeah. Hers and Terrence Howard's. He's the detective who's investigating both the murder of her fiancé and all these other murders that are happening, not realizing that the person he's talking to about the first murder is actually the person who's doing the other ones. He's phenomenal. There's a scene between the two of them. That excuse me, that moment you just played is from her radio show. She's on the air when she's doing that, and she's talking about things. And you hear the music in the background. Sounds a little bit like the Bryant Park Project, doesn't it?
I don't think it's too much to say that we inspired this film.
Obviously, and I just want to know whether you guys have guns.
I am. I have a water gun. Use on my cat when she decides to scratch the rug, but that's
totally
about as violent as I get.
No, I fired a gun a couple times in my life, and first time I did it, it kicked back and hit me. The back of the gun hit me in the eye, and my eye started bleeding, which kind of ended my relationship with firearms.
I can understand that entirely.
Let's move on to our next movie, In the Valley of Ayla. It's one of the movies at the Toronto Film Festival, one of several that had themes dealing with the Iraq War. So, Bob, what's the plot of this film, and how does it relate, the title anyway, relate to the film?
Well, the Valley of Ela is the place where David met Goliath. It's a biblical thing. And so this is about a guy who finds out that his son has gone missing after coming back from Iraq and is struggling with the authorities in the town that has the army base where that happened, because he doesn't believe what they're telling him. And Tommy Lee Jones plays the father. And he's a really... He is a David against this sort of, I don't know what you call it, just the bureaucracy that's arrayed against him to try and find out what happened to his son. And that aspect of it is kind of effective. You sort of expect there to be symbolism in a picture of this sort, because it's from Paul Haggis. He's the guy who did Crash, and he did Million Dollar Baby. He wrote Million Dollar Baby. And so he tends to weave lots of different elements together in his stories, and that's what he's done here. To my way of thinking, he also has a way of sort of sledgehammering points home so that you kind of get it, and then you get it a little harder, and then you really get it. And I felt by the end of it that I was sort of being browbeaten into...
I got it. Sometimes you're in the film, you're like movie theater, and you're like, I got it. Let's listen to a little bit of the trailer to give people a little flavor, and then I have a question for you about the cast on the other side.
Hello?
Sir, I'm calling about your son.
My son's in Iraq.
Your son was in Iraq, sir. His unit arrived stateside 4 days ago.
Anything you want to tell me? Why can't I go with you?
He's holed up someplace celebrating. Last thing he needs is his mother walking in on him.
I don't want to seem like I'm not concerned, but I expect your son will come stumbling in any time.
Sir, I regret to inform you that a body was found last night.
All right, we heard the voices of Tommy Lee Jones there, Susan Sarandon. Also, Charlize Theron plays a cop who decides to help Tommy Lee Jones in his quest. So you have three Academy Award winners. Are they able to complement one another, or is there a fight for dominance in this over-the-headness you were talking, like beat you over the head with the theme
I don't know if they're actually fighting against each other, but there's no question that Tommy Lee Jones wins. Yeah. He's taciturn in a sort of a Clint Eastwood way, so that he's there and he doesn't have to do very much for you to be drawn to him on screen. And there's no way that Charlize Theron, I think she's a wonderful actress. There's no way she can hold her own in scenes with him. He's overwhelming. Susan Sarandon does, but she's usually through most of the picture she's on the other end of the phone line, so she's actually in a separate room from him, and I guess it's easier for her to do that. She's also kind of a powerhouse actress, but they're all really good, and the picture is really well done and is absolutely earnest and means all the right things when it's talking about America and its involvement and what the involvement in Iraq is doing to the fiber of families and what it's doing to the institutions that have to deal with those families. And it's really, it wants to be powerful. I felt like it had gotten there in the first like 40 minutes and then it was powerful again. And by the end of it, I was resisting it. There's an image that they do with an American flag flying upside down that is, a sign of distress. And by the time they get to it the second time, I thought, oh, this is too obvious. This is, I know where this was going. I didn't feel that way in Crash as much. Yeah.
Good film, little heavy-handed.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Across the Universe. I'm having a hard time getting my head around this film. If you see the advertisements for it, it says Julie Taymor presents, and she was the mastermind, the creative mind behind The Lion King on Broadway. Mm-hmm. So she's trying to bring this film, this musical slash new story, all based around old Beatles songs, throwing a little bit of the hippie movement. What is going on in this film, Across the Universe?
Well, let me describe the very beginning. There is a guy sitting on the beach, and he sings. He turns to the audience and sings a question, and it is there anybody going to listen to my story, all about the girl who came to stay? And then as he continues the song, on the waves, you start to see superimposed her face and all these things that were happening in the 60s. And it's a sort of a psychedelic thing. It's all going on in his head. And then you go back to his story. And he's a kid from Liverpool who comes to the United States, who gets involved in all the things that were going on in the 60s, the Detroit riots, the death of Martin Luther King, all happens while he's in this country. And all of it is scored with these Beatles songs that they burst into music with. It's a rock opera. It's like the Who's Tommy. But the songs weren't written for this plot, so the lyrics don't necessarily work with them. Sometimes she does really clever stuff. I mean, there's a scene where one guy gets drafted, and that Uncle Sam, I Want You poster?
Yeah. Sure.
Well, it sings, I want you. Forgive me for doing that. But it sings it just like the song. Well, the song is a love song, right? But in the context, when the poster starts singing at him and all these drill sergeants then take up the song with him, that it works.
It's an opportunity to use our imagination in the movie theater. Bob Mondello, film critic for National Public Radio. Always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks stopping by.
Thank you.
I think he's packing heat.
Mondello?
Probably.
Possibly.
Probably. An Uzi or something.
I know.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, a college student who spent her summer in Afghanistan writing more or less a travel guide. We're going to talk about that coming up.
And also Counting Guy, we might be able to check in with him.
Let's
at the
see.
Very end of the show. We'll see what he's up to, a fella trying to count to a million for the heck of it.
And also the controversy around Lucy, that's the set of bones, are 33 million years old, give or take, a couple hundred thousand years. And there's a lot of controversy. She's on display in Houston. Some people think that's not a great idea. We're going to talk about that coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Them a run, them a come, them a hurt me.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Of course you can find us online. Of course you can at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. How did you spend your summer vacation? I'm guessing it wasn't in Afghanistan, but we're going to talk to someone who did just that. But first, let's get today's top news stories from our very own newscaster, Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey everyone, here's your news update. Russian President Vladimir Putin today said there are five people who could possibly succeed him and that the new prime minister, Viktor Zubkov, is one of them. Those were Putin's comments after parliament confirmed Zubkov as prime minister earlier today. Putin named the 66-year-old low-profile financial regulator to the high post after firing his government in a move that shocked political analysts. After his confirmation, Zubkov criticized the social policies of the previous government, and he said he would shuffle the cabinet, and he'd also said Russia needs to make better use of its natural resources. The trial of polygamist Warren Jeffs continues today in St. George, Utah. 51-year-old Jeffs is the leader of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's been charged with two counts of rape as an accomplice for using his church authority to coerce a marriage between a 14-year-old girl and her 19-year-old cousin. Jeffs was a fugitive for nearly 2 years and was on the FBI's most wanted list when he was arrested last year. If convicted, he could spend life in prison. There's a big auction of wireless waves scheduled for early next year that will determine what kind of data you can put on your cell phone. And yesterday, one of the big players in that auction filed suit to change the rules. In a lawsuit, Verizon Wireless has asked a U.S. Court of Appeals to strike down the FCC conditions that would require the winner of the new spectrum to let consumers connect using any device or software. Verizon argued that the open access conditions are unconstitutional. Consumer groups say the rules are necessary to spur competition in the wireless industry. O.J. Simpson, it's a name you haven't heard in the news for a while. Well, he's gotten himself into some possible trouble with the law. Police in Las Vegas are now describing Simpson as a suspect in a hotel room break-in involving sports memorabilia. Simpson was questioned about the incident at the Palace Station Casino last night, then released. He's still believed to be in Las Vegas, and police say they don't expect him to go anywhere. Police say associates of Simpson were also questioned about the theft of sports memorabilia. Investigators plan to give the reports to prosecutors today, and the DA's office will then decide whether to pursue charges. And in sports, the head coach of the New England Patriots, Bill Belichick, won't be suspended for his football espionage, but he will have to pay a $500,000 fine. The team will also be docked $250,000 and lose a first-day draft pick next year. It was the biggest fine ever for a coach, and the first time in NFL history a first-round draft pick has been confiscated as a penalty. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell found the Patriots guilty of using videotape to try to steal the New York Jets' signals during last Sunday's game. And in other sports news, it looks like the NBA's first overall draft pick of 2007, Greg Oden, will miss his entire rookie season with the Portland Trail Blazers. Oden had microfracture surgery on his right knee yesterday, and reports say a full recovery is expected to take 6 to 12 months. The news is always online at npr.org. Luke and Allison, back to you.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Well, even if you're not as up on your paleoanthropology as you should be, Allison.
You will be now.
Yeah, you've probably at least heard of Lucy, and that's the name given to a set of 3-million-year-old bones from a female hominid found in Ethiopia back in the 70s. Other older bones have since been found, but Lucy kind of remains this huge rock star of the bone community.
It's true. I actually was out to dinner with a friend of mine and her little son, Harrison, and they were talking about it, and he just kept saying, Lucy's a hominid. Lucy's a hominid. Lucy's a hominid.
Sadly, Harrison is 28. But, you know,
he's
still.
He's five.
All right. Anyway, Lucy is currently on display at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. This, though, is causing quite a stir in the science world. In fact, Richard Leakey, who is a very famous paleontologist, said the museum is using Lucy as a prostitute. That just seems harsh.
That's harsh.
And other places like the Smithsonian have actually said they're not going to show Lucy. At issue is the concern over if Lucy would get damaged by being shown. Other people say, look, this is a big cultural artifact and it's good for lots of people to see it. On the line, we've got Dr. Elizabeth Harmon, assistant professor in the anthropology department at Hunter College of New York. She's worked in Ethiopia, actually at the site where Lucy was found. Hi, Dr. Harmon.
Hi, good to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. So do you think it's a realistic concern that that Lucy or these bones are going to get damaged?
Well, it may be a realistic concern, but I think that we should remember that she's a very, very unique set of bones, and she's very, very fragile. And so to the extent that she'll be treated well, I think she'll probably be okay. But if something were to happen in the off chance that it did, it would be an irreplaceable loss for the people of Ethiopia and for the world of science.
I mean, couldn't something happen in Ethiopia, though? An asteroid could hit.
Well, actually, no, of course.
Oh, you can't.
The acts of God could always happen. But the fact of the matter is that Lucy is tucked away in a vault that's pretty impenetrable all of the time.
I see. And so I read somewhere, though, that these bones have really basically become stone at this point. Doesn't that seem like they'd be a little more durable?
Well, they are durable, but they are very, very small elements. And they are also fragile around the edges. You can imagine that even stone is fragile around the edges, and it could get damaged on the edges, or it could snap. There are a variety of things that could happen. I think it's unlikely, but these things could happen.
So, Dr. Harmon, at this point, who actually does get to see Lucy? If it's in this temperature-controlled vault somewhere.
In Ethiopia, if it never comes to America.
Yeah. I mean, are there doctors, anthropologists who check on it regularly? I mean, who sees the bones?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think that's at the heart of the issue. Most Ethiopians who revere Lucy and who have the name, a term of endearment that they use for her, they call her Dinkanesh, most of them have never, in fact, I would say nearly all Ethiopians have never seen Lucy because she's not been on display in Ethiopia. So the people who do get to see her regularly are people like me who work in the National Museum of Ethiopia on fossils. So we do check on her regularly, but it would be nice if the people of Ethiopia could actually see this set of fossils that they revere.
Dr. Harmon, you have actually looked at Lucy with your own eyes, and this is going to sound wrong, but what's so great about her?
Well, she's beautiful.
Really?
And maybe only someone like me would think so. But
okay.
She's extraordinary because while we have hundreds of fragments of her species, she's one of the few that goes together in a single individual. So while we have lots and lots of teeth, we can look at her jaw in comparison to her arms and her ribs and her legs, and she comes together as a whole individual in ways that the other fossil fragments in the drawers don't.
This is, okay, second kind of slightly impolitic question. What do fossils smell like?
Well, that's actually an interesting question. They smell a little bit like dust, as you might imagine.
Do you get kind of personally attached to a set of fossils like Lucy? I mean, we talk about these bones like they are a, you know, sort of 13-year-old girl that's sitting there coquettishly. I mean, these are some bone fragments. Do you have like a personal attachment to them, though?
I think so, and particularly something like Lucy, because you can see where her face would have been, and you can see her arms, you can see her legs, and you know that she was at one point a living, breathing, moving around, doing things individual. Mm. So there is a way that you get personally attached to fossils, but particularly fossils like Lucy that look more real.
Well, in your opinion, for our final question, I mean, the benefits of Lucy being out in the world, people seeing her versus the potential risk. What do you say? Do you vote for showing her around, or do you vote for having her locked up in a vault?
Well, I think that locked up in a vault is not necessarily the best option, but I think that it would be nice if more different kinds of people could see her. And I hope that she's safe on her travels, and I hope that to the extent that people do go see her, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, I hope that they are energized about the study of human evolution, because that's really the best outcome of this tour that's already underway.
Well, they're certainly selling tickets like gangbusters down in Houston, so at least that's happening, I guess.
Good news.
Dr. Elizabeth Harmon, assistant professor in the Anthro Department at Hunter College. Thank you very much.
I would have listened to her as a professor. She has a great voice. She drew me right on in.
I know. Oh, she's still there.
Oh.
Thank God we weren't talking
smack.
Can people
audit your classes?
Now she's
gone. Of course.
Gone.
Come on by.
I might. I'm serious. You're looking for trouble, lady.
All right. Murari Abidani. How do I say your name? Give me these pronouncers and I can't read them.
It's tough. It's, you know.
Say your name for me,
It's
please.
An ethnic name. Abdiani.
Say your first name for me.
Murari.
Murari Abdiani.
Mm-hmm. Pretty.
Murari Abdiani had a way more interesting summer than you did, okay? Deal with it. That's the reality. She's getting her MFA in creative writing at Columbia in New York, but this summer she was in Afghanistan working on basically a travel guide for foreign business people who are coming to work in Afghanistan. And there is some majorly interesting stuff going on there. Boys and girls going kind of nuts because they can actually hang out now for the first time in these fancy bars that Afghans can't really go in. Murari, first of all, you're with the studio. You're here in the studio. Thank you for coming on in.
Thanks,
I guess people already
me.
Know that because you just said your name. What was this guide you were writing? It wasn't exactly a travel guide. What was it?
Wasn't exactly a travel guide. I was there as a summer intern for an organization called Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit, acronym AREU, because everybody in Afghanistan speaks only in acronyms. But it was an assistance guide, and it was an assistance guide for pretty much the development world. It was kind of like the Bible that was, or the Quran, if you will, being passed around in Afghanistan amongst the government community, amongst the development community. And it had all the information on what all the acronyms stand for, all the different NGOs in the city, a huge contact guide, how the government works, and, maps of the country, just sort of like your basic crash course primer about how Afghanistan is working and running today.
And what parts of the country were you in geographically?
I was in Kabul, which is the capital.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what – you're Afghan yourself. You were
Afghan.
Born there.
Mm-hmm.
But how long had it been since you'd been back?
I had been back after 2001 for the first time, and I'd spent a month there and done familial things. It was the first time I'd been back in 20-some-odd years. So this was my second time back, and this is 5 years later after the United States has been in there, after the rest of the world has pretty much set up camp and, tried to what they call capacity building, help the Afghans sort of figure out how to run things. So 5 years later, it was really interesting contrast to see what's happening there now.
What was the biggest difference?
The biggest difference is that, one, there are a hell of a lot more buildings in Afghanistan now. In Kabul, there are, I think, something like 2 million people in the capital city itself. There are roads that are being paved, which are horrible roads, but they are there, and people are driving crazily. And I think there are more fatalities now than there ever were because there are more cars in the city. And if you've ever driven outside the United States, you know how chaotic that can be because
yes.
People don't all believe in rules. But there's that, and then there's just that there are more women on the streets, and people are out there just sort of doing their thing on a daily basis. So there have been slow changes have been implemented, and people are a little upset right now. I think that there hasn't been more that's been done, but from 5 years ago, there is sort of an improvement that you can visibly see on the surface.
You hear a lot about the kind of resurgence of the Taliban and the fact that they still exert a lot of influence. Is that something you can actually notice when you're just walking down a street?
You don't notice it walking down the street. I noticed it only because I was there as an expat and as an international. And, the sort of NGO security bureaus there send out daily alerts on your computer if you work for, an international organization, telling you what to look out for, where to avoid, where they might have found a car bomb, or where they suspect a suicide bomber might be. Now, the regular everyday Afghan doesn't know this and pretty much kind of is still living in a world of fear and staying inside their home and not letting their kids go out because they're very aware that they live in a very dangerous atmosphere. We sort of expats, Westerners, and Europeans are running around kind of like, not that we don't care, but as if, it's not a real danger to us because it's not part of our existence.
But it's not Baghdad where
it's
you
not
just
the
are
green
in
zone.
Terror.
No. It's usually – while I was there this summer, the situation got bad. There was a suicide bomber that killed 35 people on a bus. It was a lot of Afghan national police that were pretty much blown up, And there was another day we were out and we had missed another suicide bomber by just 5 minutes. We had driven, to the opposite side of town. So the reality is there. Most of the time it's on the outside of the city, but it's coming into the city. And as far as the Taliban, it is the Taliban and it isn't. I mean, there's a lot of funding of different sort of factional, militias going on. The Taliban, we like to put down in the media that the Taliban is sort of one lump sum big bad guy group. Mm-hmm. And they're not. They're a bunch of different little tribes who are warring with each other over certain things and then warring with the government too. They're not all one big lump sum group. So
did you see, I'm curious, any American adventure tourists with Khalid Hassani books under their arms, the Kite Runner and the Thousand Suns, who've decided, I must see this place.
Everybody
maybe
there.
Don't. Yeah?
Now, everybody there likes to go there and romanticize Afghanistan. And it's easy to do because, I mean, it's easy to fall in love with a place that's so incredibly surreal. And you're walking into a country that has some of the most headiest people there right now. So you are there amongst journalists, amongst writers, amongst photographers, amongst filmmakers. And you know, and then you are there amongst the Afghan people who have an incredible sense of hospitality, but who are also, in a way, their culture is kind of, you know, they have returnees now, refugees that are returning from Iran and Pakistan and other places. And so that culture that was originally there is now being rediluted again, and things are changing and evolving. And yeah, everybody's got their copy of Kite Runner under their arm. You know, everybody's reading
Land of a Thousand Suns.
Yes. And, you know, and he's a big star there. And, you know, and the Afghans, they've got the internet now. So, you know, the minute I got there, they Googled me to see who I was and where I came from. I mean, the world is a very small place now, and somebody in Kabul can know who you are and what you're up to and, you know, how you feel about things. So,
well, let's get down to the important stuff. Boys and girls and music. What's happening on the single scene in Afghanistan right now?
Well, what's happening on the single scene in Afghanistan is that, well, families are still very much in control of who marries whom. And, you know, it's a big tribal society. It's a big familial-based society. There's not a huge sense of the self or the I, you know. So as far as dating, it happens, and it's underground. And thanks to cell phones and email and text messages, all of that, you know, secret rendezvous can happen, but it's not out in the open. It's not spoken about publicly. And it is an Islamic republic, and you don't want to disrespect your parents. So the office atmosphere, the college campus atmosphere now is a place where young men and women who have families who are free enough to allow them to go and work or go to school, now they can talk to one another, you know, and they do fantasize and dream about sort of hooking up and doing these things. But it's one of my colleagues said to me, and he put it best, and he said, you know, everyone in Afghanistan is married to someone but in love with someone else.
Oh, so that's heartbreaking.
It's really, I mean, everything is, yeah, it is kind of heartbreaking.
Did you get hit on a lot?
Well, maybe.
Mirani, I'm going to do this right, okay? Mirari, first I'm going to say your first name right, then I'm going to say your last name right. Mirari Abdiani,
right.
Thank you so much for coming on the
Thanks,
Bryant
guys.
Park Project. Is this book going to be out? This guide going to be out that people can actually read it? Can,
this
they, can
guide,
we get our hands on
this
it?
This guide will be out. You can go to areu.org.af. And that is the organization's website. They have a guide. They do a lot of policy briefing papers. So anything you ever wanted to know about Afghanistan, it's a wonderful, wonderful organization. Knock yourselves out.
All right, we'll put the link to that on our old website in case you didn't write that down. Thank you, Mirari, for coming on.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, can we just really quick, we have 55 seconds left.
Oh. Counting Guy. You
yes.
want to go to Counting
yes.
Guy? Counting Guy's on his couch doing an interview right now. Can we pop that up? We were worried that he wouldn't do an interview with us, but he stopped counting for a minute for his 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah, that is boring sounding. Okay, that's the guy at milliontcount.com. He's counting to a million. He's going to get there this afternoon. We should try to talk to him on Monday.
That's going to do our very, very best for that. This is our very, very best edition of the Bryant Park Project for this Friday, September 14th. We don't have to say goodbye. You can always hang out with us online at npr.org/Bryant Park. We never leave. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. 501. 502.
Our staff includes Ilya Meritz, MG Davis, David Van Pashman, Wynn Rosenfeld, Carrie Toby, and Rachel Martin. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Our editor, Tricia McKinney.
I'm Luke Burbank. Did you leave someone out?
I was going to let you say who our executive producer is.
Oh, yeah, Sharon Hoffman. Welcome back.
There you go.
Let's go have a weekend.
All right. Thanks for listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.